Greetings, everyone. Back during the previous song we were all singing, I was singing a sort of a trio with John and the pianist, and afterward, well, I suggested coming out with them, and they gave me kind of a funny look, so it embarrassed me. So I decided to wait and come out after them. I don't think they felt I was qualified to come out and join them at all. Anyway, we have those trials, and I know we're all familiar with those things. I've had, I know a lot of people are drawn many different directions the last few days, but many are very loyal and encouraging, and I hope all of you are trying to be loyal and encouraging through the trials we're going through, and we certainly all need each other's prayers. I got a real warm and encouraging note from my friend that I work with really many years over the years in the faculty, and most recently the last couple of years in the Los Angeles church, Mordecai Joseph, and he said, "Hang in there and be strong." He signed it Mordecai the Jew. And Mordecai and I used to persecute each other when we were down in the Los Angeles church and tell the problems of our individual lives. And I thought it might be helpful to tell you some things about Mordecai, about when he first came to the United States and was in New York. And he went down to Coney Island and was swimming there. And all of a sudden he was drowning. And as he was out in the ocean, not used to swimming here and away from the Israel area and the big waters we have here and the higher waves. So he nearly drowned. Virtually he half drowned before the lifeguard came and pulled him out. And so the friends later were telling him, as they revived him and toweled him and got him going and all, they said, "Well, listen, you'd better give that lifeguard at least a dollar. He saved your life." So Mordecai thought and reached into his pocket and gave the lifeguard some money. He said, "Here's 50 cents. He said, "You saved my half my life. And so I want to pay you this." Anyway, then on the way into town, since this took a long time and the bus service was over and the trains had stopped running, they were able to get a taxi. And on the way into town, why, the cab driver lost control of the vehicle and it was careening wildly. And somehow he felt the steering, was broken and everything was going awry. And he said, "Something's wrong. I can't control the car." And he began to just scream and pound on the steering wheel. And as they were going along, Mordecai said, "Well, at least you could turn off the meter." So anyway, that's the way it goes. I think in all fairness, we're going to have to let Mordecai come up here and preach a sermon at one of these times soon so he can have his chance. And then he'll tell some on me. We're used to that in Los Angeles, so I hope no one misunderstands. Anyway, we have to do those things to one another in the grim times to carry on. Well, brethren, I think you've all heard of the changes, and they've been very traumatic from people of every persuasion in the church, and I'm sure you understand that, and I have a great deal of sympathy for those involved. I really do, because changes are hard, and they're difficult, and they're shocking in times of war, in times of strife, in times of battle. Sometimes we change battle strategy real quick, and for reasons that he has, and I don't want to go over that. We went over that yesterday morning, and we went over that yesterday afternoon with the ministers, and we went over that last night with some of you here, perhaps at least briefly. But Mr. Armstrong did decide to appoint me as the new director of pastoral administration. As I think you know, I noticed the Los Angeles Times said that I'm now the top this or that. They gave me a better billing, and the local paper gave Mr. McNair the better billing and put his picture in. I guess the Times knew better than to put my picture in so it wouldn't break their cameras. But anyway, I'm just kidding about all that. We're none of us are top anything. Jesus Christ is top, and we'd better all know that. And I know that deeply and fervently. And under him, Mr. Armstrong is top. And there are three or four of us here that are to work together as a team. And then on out, dozens of others are going to work together as a team. And then hundreds of us on campus are going to work together as a team. And then the ministers and the people in the field, thousands of us are going to work together as a team. So I'm sure that all of us are going to have to do that, and we will get the job done. I did talk to Mr. Armstrong a while ago. He is stronger, and he hopes to be here next Sabbath. I don't know whether or not he'll make it, but he hopes to. He's getting over this flu, I think, and he had a little mild, at least a little fever and a very hoarse throat. So whether it was a flu or not, I shouldn't mention the word flu. He didn't, but he said, "I'm trying to come down with one." You know what I mean? He was afraid he would. But I think he is stronger, and hope he'll be here next Sabbath himself. I'd like to point out, too, there are all kinds of rumors just flying every which way. And please, brethren, don't believe all these rumors. And I'm sorry, I'm going to have to even disclaim something on television, but I'm not going to name anybody but I'll just say that this is the official statement from the one who is responsible in this office. I'm responsible in this particular office as far as the ministry at this particular point and disfellowships and things like that, and nobody has been disfellowshipped, period. One or two have been suspended, but nobody has been disfellowshipped in this particular crisis of the last few days, period. And there may have to be a few disfellowships depending upon the future conduct and attitude and other facts as they come out. And I want to try to have time to talk to the individuals involved. I want to make peace. I want to help us all to have the opportunity to serve as much as we can. God wants all of us to exercise our full human potential, every last one of us. And as we work together as a team, I'm sure we can do that. But we're not trying to start anything real quick. And I'm sorry that those rumors have got started. And I'm sorry that the situation has developed in that particular way. Also, I would like to apologize very sincerely, as I did to several ministers who told me about it yesterday after our ministerial meeting. We even had it, and then they chatted with me. And then I did apologize last night. I think I asked Mr. Luker, too, this morning. I'm not sure if I did ask him to do that or not. I don't want to put him on the spot. There have been so many things. We've all been saying this and that. But at least I want to publicly apologize to you brethren here and those of you who may be listening in the Imperial Gym. Hello to you, as Mr. LaRavia said, and to those who might be in the Student Center. But I want to apologize for the confusion that was here yesterday. I understand that even some of God's ministers who were coming in were kind of blocked, and one or two held up their hands and then tried to shove the door closed because we had heard, and I'd heard myself, but then Mr. McNair and others who were here had heard, and some people from outside, but Mr. Armstrong's employees had heard and were telling us there was going to be a march here and they were going to crash the stage and try to take over the meeting, which indeed one or two seemed to be trying to do, and I'm not judging, but certainly I was involved in that. They seemed to be trying to do that right after the meeting we had yesterday morning. So it wasn't based or fabricated at all. Obviously, something was in someone's mind, and no one dared deny that. But at any rate, many have told me they didn't plan the group that just came together to do that. But there was the misunderstanding, and, the people were saying no, and they wanted to get outside and talk to them to be sure of their attitude before they let them in, and there was some pushing and shoving. And that was not right, and I apologize for that. I sincerely do. I never even hinted to anyone anything like that, and I'm sorry that that happened, and I'm sure Mr. Armstrong would. Nobody got hurt at all and in any way, and as I said, I sincerely don't think anyone got hurt one-tenth as much as the average player would in an NFL football game, you know, as they will be having tomorrow. That still does not relinquish the fact or do away with the fact that there was some, confusion and this type of thing that should not have been. And when you have big problems and riots and so on in the world, you know, you always have someone. And I'm grateful it wasn't worse than it was. I'm also sorry about the sensational news reports where they try to make it more interesting, you know, by saying this and saying that. And they were showing that I was this or that, which I have not been appointed, as I said, at all to be any top anything. I'm just the bond slave of Jesus Christ and your servant, and I hope I can do a good job. If God doesn't like me, He will kick me out, and God is going to run this church through His servant, Jesus Christ of Nazareth, and through His human servant, Mr. Armstrong. As long as he's faithful, and as long as I'm faithful, I'm sure that God will be with us. And I hope that you'll all pray for us, and this will work out. I do want to say also that I do intend to reprimand and stop any future shoving and pushing, and we tried to have all the deacons be very warm and courteous and let anybody in and who comes, and perhaps we have people here from every persuasion, I'm sure, and if someone tries to corner you afterward and tell you about the latest revelation from Elijah or something, why, be prepared, you know. Or if someone interviews you, well, they might be for the Ambassador Report or some Yellow Sheet Journal, or they might be from the Los Angeles Times. I'm sure everyone is listening here, so I'll try to be a little bit more careful about what I say rather than roaring and snorting here this afternoon. I've got new responsibilities. Oh, how peaceful it was down in Los Angeles, you know, just to get up and preach the word. Wow. Anyway, I want to also say, as I did tell the brethren last night on Mr. Armstrong's direct authority and statement to me, that he does plan to remove Mr. Rader as treasurer, or that Mr. Rader has agreed to step down, and it's a mutual thing, as treasurer of the work. And that is going to be taken care of, or has been taken care of. I don't know whether that has been announced directly or put in writing or whatever, but Mr. Rader will be stepping down at any rate and relinquish all responsibility over the financial affairs of the church. All responsibility over the financial affairs of the church and all management in the church and the college, and will devote himself exclusively to the Ambassador Foundation. and to, of course, being Mr. Armstrong's personal assistant, and that's all. And I'm just going to say this right openly. And I've told Mr. Rader, in fact, in a conversation last night, I said, Stan, no, I told the ministers that this afternoon, and I told maybe he called, maybe it was this morning. We keep getting calls from him, and Mr. Armstrong, Mr. McNair, Mr. everybody. Mr. LaRavia got to me this morning in my pajamas, and and they kept up till about midnight last night, and I got to bed sometime after midnight, and then they woke me up before 7 o'clock this morning. The call started again, so I'm living a new life. I was really gaining weight, and I was getting a little bit of a tummy around here, and congratulating Cheryl on her cooking and so on, and now, pow, you know. So anyway, we do need your prayers. But anyway, Mr. Armstrong did assure me that that was what he intended to do, and I told Mr. Rader, I said, I'm going to have to announce that, and I know that people are all confused, and all these attacks have been leveled at us, that Mr. Rader's this and that. Well, you don't know that, and I don't know that. There's been no proof whatsoever. But if Mr. Rader has absconded with funds in any way at all, then let's let the courts get that out. Let's give them full access to all of that, and let's be sure that it is brought out. And I think we want it brought out. I want it brought out. I want you to know it's brought out, and I want to be sure that this is the cleanest and the most honest and the most decent and the most wholesome church on the face of the earth if we work together and pray together and can make it that way under God. And we have His Spirit. We have His message. We have His law and the real understanding of it, and we certainly have the opportunity to do that very thing. So I'm sure, brethren, if we do our part, it can be that way. So we're not accusing Mr. Rader. I'm just saying that because of these rumors, that has been just an almost obsession with many people against Mr. Rader, and I hope we can get a balance on that and let God take care of it and let the worldly courts, and they are human ministers that God uses, and the auditors, and if that's done, well, then that's going to be fine. And I hope everyone here, and I want to personally ask everyone here, too, as I know Mr. LaRavia would agree, and everyone else on our team. I mean, I will ask every one of you who's sitting out here or in the other gym or the student center who's in the business department or the data processing center or anyone else, I want to charge you on the authority of Jesus Christ publicly right now to cooperate with these auditors and to not withhold anything that would bring out any financial malfeasance by anybody, including me and my wife and my children and my dog. And I mean it. I mean that, brethren, and I mean those of you who are listening in. I want you to cooperate and not try to cover up anything. I don't want anything to be covered up, and we do not want anything to be covered up. And I hope we all understand that, and I really hope that gets out loud and clear. And if I get in trouble for saying that, so be it. But that's got to be said, and that's got to be the way it is in God's church. Now, we do need love, and we need unity and togetherness in God's church. And I know that as brothers, and if we try to treat ourselves, each other that way, I should say, we will have that. And I know that we all have that attitude in the end when we think and pray about it. So let's do pray about it, and let's work on that. And if in the rush of events and the lack of sleep and the pressure and people coming with this and that at you, some of us have been a little bit short or in our conversation, or maybe I chop people off on the phone because they call from every direction, and I can't even eat my breakfast, and then during lunch you get two bites, and there it goes again, and finally we just took the phone off the hook, and then people in meetings will bring this up, and maybe they just want to get it off their chest, but seem to be attacking Mr. Armstrong, and I'm trying to defend him. I don't want that 86-and-a-half-year-old man attacked and attacked and attacked. I don't think that's necessary, and I don't think that's godly. But I don't mean to cut people off in the wrong way either, and if I have, I apologize for that. But we all want to work together as brothers and forgive one another and build on solid foundations. Now, brethren, we're at a testing time in God's work, and I think we all deeply know that. We are going through what is probably the greatest test of this work so far. We may have said that before, and at previous occasions we have had the greatest test, perhaps back in 1972. And then we had the greatest test in 1974, but because of the cumulative upset and problems, this is indeed an even greater test. And I think we all recognize that. I think any thinking person would have to say amen to that. Many could start gossiping about the work, gossiping and evaluating in every possible way, which many are already starting to do, or even feeling sorry and disgusted about the work and about Mr. Armstrong personally. Others could get bitter or discouraged or just say, who cares? I always remember a very fine and I think heartfelt prayer that was offered in one of our services during one of these times of trial. I think it was in 74, but by an older man, and I'm not trying to get him older than he is, but by Mr. Selmer Hegvold, whom I've known for many, many years, and has had been the father, of course, of 8 children, some of whom are in God's work. And Mr. Hegel, during this time of trial, got up and in his deep, older voice, this former major or lieutenant colonel in the Army during the Second World War, I sort of looked at that, I guess, but anyway, he said, "Father, thank you for the trials." He just said that right out in a public prayer. "Thank you for the trials." And I had my head bowed, and I thought, that's right. You know, I'd better get a better attitude. Thank you for the trials. Because sometimes we learn by trials, and God sorts things out in a way that He wants by trials, in a way that might not have occurred any other way. And perhaps certain attitudes are being tested, and certain situations in the work from various problems we've had and facets are being sorted out in this particular trial in a way that could never have been done in any other way, to see where people really stand and whether they are really humble and are willing to humble themselves and let God exalt them, or exalt themselves and let God humble them, or whatever it is. I don't know. I'm not speaking about any one or any dozen or any 10 dozen persons. I'm just talking about all of us here as Christians. We should say thank you for the trials. Out in the world, people have all kinds of trials. And I think you all recognize that Exxon and a bunch of these big oil companies, they're talking about us having problems with some money that's ripped off, and if 1 cent is ripped off from God's church, that's awful. But then on page 3, I think it was, or 5, I noticed in the Times, or the Star News, have gotten them mixed up, but after this talk about our problems in that way, then they have this fact that these companies are accused of ripping off the government of over $2 billion. That's back on page 5 or whatever, you know what I mean. And that's not a big deal. Ours is more sensational. But they have trials, and of course some of them bring their trials on themselves, and sometimes we do too, because we're human, and I will acknowledge that. Sometimes Boeing loses a big government contract, and all the employees, you know, or all the new employees, I should say, have to be laid off. And they have to move to other areas and get new jobs, and they have trials. Every people on earth, every organization on earth does, and I hope that this is the last, and maybe I'm too optimistic, I know, but I sort of hope at least, and feel that maybe this, in process, I don't mean this week, but I mean this next few months, may well be the last of this kind of trial from the inside, and then we can have our trials from the outside again, and more than we have ever had, as we get this work really going and growing. And I hope that we can and that we will. We do need to keep things in perspective, though, and recognize that our trials are not those of Peter and Paul, who were beaten, who were had their clothes jerked off of them and lashed up, you know, to some boards or a wooden frame, and had this big man, a muscle man, trained, you know, as the whipper, the lictor, or whatever he was called, to administer the licking and take the cat o' nine tails and just tear the hide right off your back. I don't think we've had that kind of trials yet. Our trials are a little different. So let's understand and keep things in perspective. Because if we do, and if we continue to be the people that I know the vast majority of you have been, and the vast majority of all of us here, I hope, have been and will be, well, we will continue to be God's work, and God will use us and bless us more than ever. And I know that we can do that. In Matthew 24, and beginning in verse 8, Jesus has been describing the trials, in a sense, the punishments and the plagues that are going to be brought on the world at the time of the end. He talks about wars and world wars, famines, pestilences, earthquakes in different places. And Jesus said, all these are the beginning of sorrows. Then shall they deliver you up to be afflicted during this period of time, and shall kill you, and you shall be hated of all nations for my name's sake. And then, at this very time, when these things begin to occur and these things are in process of happening, and then shall many be offended and shall betray one another and shall hate one another. And the many false prophets shall rise and deceive many. And brethren, where he starts out talking, where you shall be afflicted and they shall kill you and all this and that, the obvious emphasis through this passage is on God's people, because the outside world has already been deceived. You know, God doesn't need to deceive them, or the devil doesn't need to deceive them all over again. They've already been deceived. But he shows how people are going to have that happen to them. And he says in verse 11, many false prophets shall rise and shall deceive many, not just a few. And of course, those are obviously people who have some knowledge of God at that time, or they couldn't be deceived if they were already deceived. And so many false prophets are going to arise, and many situations arise to test us. We don't have false prophets arising now. I'm not implying that. I'm just saying tests of this sort. And because iniquity shall abound, because this world is filled right today, as Mr. LaRavia said, and I didn't ask him to say it or know he was going to say it at all, but I certainly say amen to his fine talk and to Mr. Wilson's very fine report and talk and encouragement on the Australian work, and appreciate the job and the attitude of loyalty and faithfulness and dedication and the fine work that both of those men and so many, many others of our ministers here are doing as being loyal to God's work through this crisis and so many others. But, brethren, God does let us know in the Bible, in many examples, and we see it in the nation now, that there is an attitude of judgment abroad, as he was saying, a judgmental attitude and an attitude of criticizing, an attitude of constantly rioting and demanding and marching and doing this and doing that. And I noticed on KFWB this morning, I think they commented a little on us, and then they went on to this riot or this pressure group, this march on City Hall, and this group was going to do this, and they went on. It was kind of interesting because, you know, we were just one of many. They just go on here and there and there and there, and all over people are rioting, and they're agitating, and they're demanding this. And this kind of an attitude is abroad in our society. There's not an attitude of submission to authority abroad in our society. It is the most judgmental and rebellious and so on attitude that perhaps has ever existed in the American society up until this day. That attitude, of course, is an attitude that will bring about man's utter rebellion against God and all the prophecies that God talks about, and it is an attitude that will drastically change after our people are brought down and are starving to death in concentration camps, and they say, "Oh God, God, please have mercy. Please, if I could just eat. I'm not going to demand this and demand that. If I could just have a drink of water, if I could just eat, if I could just be taken away from this torture situation or whatever it is, the whole attitude will change." But we've got to have our attitudes changed here and now and try not to let that attitude or spirit of rebellion and demanding, and we want this and we want it now. I might say that to all of you that a lot of people have the feeling right now, well, we've been patient through 72 and through 74 and the other problems, and now we've got this, have this total thing right out. Everybody look at all the raw livers of everybody who's involved in any problem and dissect them and criticize them, pick them to pieces or whatever, and everything has got to be solved right now. Well, it won't be solved right now, and it certainly won't be solved right now if we all have to spend so much time calming that down to keep the organization even from falling apart, you see, that our energies are devoted so much to that that we can't get at these other problems. That's one of the big things. And I'd like to say to all of you sitting here this afternoon that I've only been in my job less than 48 hours. I hope all of you realize that. I've been in my job less than 48 hours. And if you'd even just give me 48 days and give Mr. Armstrong 48 days, I think you're going to find a number of changes along the lines that people are concerned about. And some of these, as I've announced, are already taking place. So please don't think it has to all occur like some miracle from heaven within 48 hours. I'm not saying wait 48 more months. I don't think we should remotely wait 48 more months at all. But we might have to wait for 48 days and on some big long-range things to get whole new programs really instituted. Maybe we'd say 48 weeks or something, which would be the better part of a year. But I think we're going to have a lot of changes and growth and togetherness in various ways within even 48 days. I'm just using that as a figure of speech since I've only been here less than 2 days. So I hope we can understand that and not let this attitude affect us of rebellion and we want this now and we demand and so forth from the world. Jesus said because iniquity, and the Greek word here is lawlessness, this attitude we do what we want to do and when we want to and how we want to and so on, because lawlessness shall abound, the love of many shall wax cold. And they just say, "Oh, I don't care this and that," and they just decide to do what they want to do. But he that shall endure to the end, the same shall be saved. Well, we didn't know what that meant 10 years ago, but we've been learning, haven't we? What it means to endure to the end. You say, "Oh, how long is the end?" But I know another man and I had some rocks thrown at us and boards broken over us one time, this guy hitting us on baptizing tour and got a few little bloody or raw places from it. And Mr. McNair and I had guns pointed at us a couple times on our baptizing tour where we were threatened to, be shot. I remember this little tiny guy in Texas or Mississippi or somewhere in the South, And he came out just quietly. We'd come to see his wife and pulled up in this Chrysler that Mr. Armstrong let us drive on this thing, because we were driving thousands of miles as two young men on these long drives. And we pulled up to this place and this farm and started to get out and go in. And he came out and kept the gate closed and noticed he had this 22 under his arm. He walked out there, and so we were friendly. We said, "Well, we're Roderick Meredith and Raymond McNair from Ambassador College, and we'd like to see your wife, and she's written so on and so on and so forth." And we could detect that we might possibly have a problem when he came out with that gun, you know. And he just pointed that right at us, and he said, real nasal, you know, worse than me. He said, "Git." And they said, "Well, now, your wife wrote us, and we're not here to sell her. We just want to talk to her about the Bible a little bit. We'd be glad to have you right there, sir." He kind of waved. He said, "You get." And then we said something else, and he said, "You better get right now." And we did. I think we later turned that name over to Mr. Swisher or somebody, and I understand... no, I don't mean we sent them there, but we where that woman could go to them and get baptized, and I think she did get baptized later. But we decided that wisdom was the better part of valor at that particular occasion. Anyway, we do have to endure to the end, and but most of us haven't had too many bloody trials yet, and we're grateful for that. Now, back in Colossians chapter 1 and verse 15, God is describing here the great power of Christ, who is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of every creature, for by him were all things created. They are in heaven, they are in earth, visible and invisible, whether they be thrones, dominions, principalities, or powers. All things were created by him and for him. And he is before all things, and by him all things consist. And he, Christ, is the head of the body, the church, who is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, that he might have preeminence in all things. Christ is our living and our active head. And brethren, again, it's so easy to get our minds off that. I know it is me, and we just need to get back quietly and study the Bible and look at the big picture. As I said, get the right perspective. He puts us through these trials, and yet we can see, and I saw back in 71 and 72 when certain things happened, that people I always knew were weak or had a lot of this or that problem, many of them were the main ones that left at that particular point. It seems like God is sorting things out. I don't mean that I always knew it, and I can say I told you so. I don't mean that, but some are just obvious. And then in 74 and so on, certain things happened, and it became obvious. God is trying us, and he's sorting us out. And as you look back, you can see that those whose hearts were right, and those who didn't have an attitude that I want things the way I want them, and I want them right now, that are genuinely humble and patient and walking in the fear of God, they're still with us, and they will continue to be with us, and nothing will shake them, and Christ will never leave us nor forsake us, and he will never leave or forsake them. And if they have Christ in them, they will never leave nor forsake us. But those who want their own way, those who are easily hurt, you know, who get their feelings hurt very quickly, and who do not have that fear of God to the same degree, you know, great peace have they that love thy law, and nothing shall offend them. They can easily get upset and leave. And again, I say, I don't want to have to qualify this to any of you brethren here or ministers, visiting ministers, anyone else. I don't mean by that this is an excuse for us not to change, because I know people, some of you may have thoughts just pounding through your mind. Yes, but let's get this out and let's look at it and let's argue about it. I don't mean that. We're going to have to make these changes. We're going to have to work together. We're going to have to do a job. We're going to have to expose evil and make good and do all the rest of it. But I mean that still, if we're in the process of doing that, and we're moving forward, and we're still preaching the truth and doing God's work, why, if people are in the right attitude, I repeat, they're not just going to go running off from us and get hysterical, because the whole problem in the work of the world is not solved in one day or two days or even 1 or 2 years, although I hope that the vast majority of our problems are solved within the next year. I really do, of the type I'm talking about, of recent date, just among and between ourselves and this type of thing. And I pray that, and I hope all of you will pray that fervently. But let's keep our minds on the real leadership. The real leadership is not Herbert Armstrong. The real leadership is not any one of us here today or anywhere else on earth humanly. But the real leadership is Jesus Christ. And we've got to have confidence in that and really believe that. That's an article of faith, that Jesus Christ is the head of this church. And it must be. And we've got to do that and ask him to sort things out. And I hope all of you will. I hope that you will pray fervently that Christ will be in charge and He will assert His leadership more than ever, and that He will guide and lead and inspire His servant, Mr. Armstrong. And ask God right now, if you wish to, in your mind, and ask God as you go home from this service to guide that man's mind and to give him understanding and knowledge and insight and spiritual discernment to grasp the attitudes of all those around him with whom he's dealing, and to see who is truly a man of God and who is not, and who ought to be in this or that or some other job, and to do it sincerely and to do it humbly. Ask God in heaven to guide his mind and inspire him and lead him and to give him wisdom and judgment and foresight and vision and big-mindedness to see the big picture as God would want him to. And if you do that, I know that God will guide him, as indeed he has, but he does need our prayers. And ask God to give him the physical and the mental energy and strength and power and the faith and the courage to go ahead and do what needs to be done in this work. So let's have our confidence in Christ, and then we can have proper human confidence in Mr. Armstrong or any human leaders under him, as we know that Christ is going to be in charge and guide the situation. And you will see the answer by the fruits over the next few months. In Ephesians, the first chapter, it talks again about Christ, the power that God wrought in Christ in verse 20, Ephesians 1, verse 20, when he raised him from the dead and set him at his own right hand in the heavenlies, as the Greek said, right up there in glory with the four living creatures and the 24 elders. And there is Christ in all that glory and majesty and power sitting at the very right hand of God, far above all principality and power and might and dominion and every name that is named, not only in this world but also in that which is to come. And he has put all things under his feet and gave him Christ to be the head over all things to the church, which is his body, the fullness of him that fills all in all. Brethren, Christ is to be the head of the church in every way. He's to be the head of the church in regard to the church administration. He's to be the head of the church in regard to publishing, to be the head in regard to our data processing, and to the in the editorial, and to be the head in media, and to be the head in the YOU programs and the YES programs and every other program that we have, in Ambassador College, as I said, and all the rest of it. Christ is to be the head of his church and of the work of his church, and we are to ask him and should ask him now more than ever to intervene and to guide and lead and inspire and also to sort out. And you can ask him that and should do, as long as you do it in a right way. And I hope you'll do that for me. I need it. I don't want to be here if I shouldn't be here. All I'm going to do is bring sorrow on myself, on my family, on you, on Mr. Armstrong, and on my living head and my Savior, Jesus Christ. If he doesn't want me to be here, I hope he will take me away. And I mean that sincerely, brethren. And I've let it happen before without fighting about it, and I will let it happen again. And I ask your prayers in that way for me, for Mr. McNair, for Mr. LaRavia, for Mr. Helge, for Mr. Rader. You should even pray that for him, yes. In spite of any accusations, and that's what they are at this point, and certainly for Mr. Herbert Armstrong and any of the other leadership of our area coordinators and the other leading men in the church here, the evangelists and pastors and the teachers in the college and all the other men, the fine men in publishing and editorial and the rest of it. Say, Father in heaven, please intervene and rebuke and chasten in mercy and in wisdom, but rebuke and chasten and cleanse and purge and fashion and mold this church. Help us, please help us to really get on the ball and to honor you, and that your way and your truth and your love and your wisdom and your power may shine out from us and from our wives and from our children and from our work and the impact we have on others. And as much as humanly can be, everything we think and say and do. We are the weak of the world. We're not the great of the world. I wish I were 6 foot three and 215 pounds. I used to say, I think I've told you this story, how I had that all figured out years ago, and I had the picture of Charles Atlas and Joe Bonomo and John Grimmick and Steve Stanko and later Steve Reeves all up on the wall of my bedroom when I was a 13-year-old pimple-faced teenager, and I was taking all these weightlifting courses, and I'd get in front of the mirror every night, look at myself, you know, and I could see these things amidst the pimples, and I thought, I'm making progress. And I thought, you know, 6 foot three, 215 pounds. And it never happened. And I just can't believe it. It never happened. And, you know, I could say I wish I had that build and I had, you know, somebody else's scholastic ability and someone else's personality and someone else's singing or speaking voice, and someone else is this or that or something else. And I intend to get all those things too. Do you know that? Now, I think you know what I'm saying if you think just a minute. I may not be that really physically, but you know what I mean. When we're in God's family, we're going to have all those things to the degree that we need them. We can be as big or as strong or as this or that, but in the meantime, we're a bunch of worms crawling out on this little... You and I are those little wiggle worms. Welcome to the club. But that's what we are. And it's kind of good for us to realize that about ourselves. I mean that honestly. I don't care how great you are or how weak you are. All of us are fellow worms. King David said, I'm but a worm. And Job realized finally that he was a worm. And I am a worm. And all of us are. And we've got to realize how weak we are and how short we fall and how much we need God and Christ to do it and how we can't do it. But if we have that attitude, I know eventually we will do it. That is, those things that need to be done by us in this life. In chapter 4 of Ephesians, God tells us, as I mentioned this last time, but I'll give it again here. In verse 3, he tells us to be endeavoring to keep the unity of the Spirit and the bond of peace. We are to build unity. And there is one body, one Spirit, even as you're called, in one hope of your calling. One Lord, one faith, one baptism. God is not all divided. God doesn't want us to all be divided. Do we want to have this church and that church and that church and that church and something else? Is that really what God wants? Does that honor God for people to go out and do that from the basic church that is still doing God's work under the one anointed of God, the one man that even most of those recognize, not all of them, but many of them recognize is still God's apostle? Do we want to do that? It's kind of confusing, and it's certainly ungodly. And so God does not want that, and I think we all recognize that. Certainly we all should. And it shows how Christ descended, of course, in the grave and ascended above all heavens that he might fulfill all, verse 10. And here, verse 11 now, going ahead, he, Christ, gave some apostles, some prophets, some evangelists, some pastors and teachers. He put them in the church. That's his doing. That's the government of God. And as I've said, brethren, and I don't want to harp on it too much, but I'll tell you, this is a time we need to think about that. What are your tithes and offerings being spent for, basically? And they are. I don't want any smart guy thinking otherwise. They are. The vast overwhelming majority of your tithes and offerings are and have been spent on radio and TV time, publishing and doing the work of God, sometimes too much on Ambassador College, and that began to be a problem. I'll say that. I'm saying that as one who was just the dean of the college. No one's fired me yet, although they should, but they haven't. I can't do both jobs. But I love Ambassador College and always will and so on. But you know what I mean. We did get to spending too big a proportion, but even that was intended to be training people for the work and this and that. And that's the big thing that we're praying for and that our prayers are for, the coming kingdom or government of God. And that's the whole thing. Government from the top down. And God has put officers in that government, some apostles, some prophets, some evangelists, some pastors and teachers. And so we are to think about the government of God and submit to the government of God. And if we can't do that now and be together and recognize that government, we're total misfits to be in the kingdom of God tomorrow. We really are, because that's the whole basic thing that we need to be concerned with. So I set these ministers for the perfecting of the saints, for the work of the ministry. We're to build the work, and we're to get this message to the world for the edifying of the body of Christ. We are to build you up. Till we all come in the unity of the faith and of the knowledge of the Son of God, and we are to be together in unity and have that same basic approach to God and not all be divided among ourselves. Unto a perfect man. Yes, God does want us to be perfect. It's not wrong to want to be perfect. And we should strive for perfection. That doesn't mean we condemn someone if they don't achieve instant perfection, but we should strive with all our hearts, not just to be barely all right, but to really be as much as we can be like God in every facet of our lives. A perfect man under the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ. The ministry is to encourage you to build your body, mind, personality, character, your family, your wife, your children, your job, everything about you to be like Christ the best way you can. And all of us fall so far short, but I hope we're making progress. And I think we are, and we should be. That henceforth we be no more children tossed to and fro and carried about with every wind of doctrine, with the sleight of men and cunning craftiness whereby they will lie in wait to deceive, but speaking the truth in love may grow up unto him in all things which is the head, even Christ. And so, brethren, be careful we're not tossed to and fro by conflicting doctrines and conflicting ideas or even conflicting rumors, and let those things take you away from the basic thing which this church has been doing and is doing, and I pray and I believe, and I do believe, will continue doing more effectively and more powerfully than ever after this cleansing and purging we've been getting this year, this past year, you know, from about Pentecost 1978, perhaps on through Pentecost 1979, might be the final cleansing and purging and reorganization of this work, where we will finally have men who are leading the work under Mr. Armstrong, who are truly, for about the first time in 10 years, genuinely together under Mr. Armstrong in their attitudes, their loyalty to him, and also their loyalty to the doctrines and the teachings and the way of life that that man has taught. And there has not always been that during the last 10 years, as you know, which is perhaps an understatement on my part. I'm not trying to dramatize it. There has not always been that by any means in those areas. But I think we can have that now. We really can. And I hope and pray that we will, and the work can be done in that spirit. Now, in chapter 6 of Ephesians, Paul tells us, "Finally, my brethren, be strong in the Lord and in the power of His might. Put on the whole armor of God, that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil." He's talking here about Satan the devil, and he is alive and he is real. "For we wrestle not." Our battle is not against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this world, against wicked spirits in high places. And brethren, there are wicked spirits, and they are moving, and they're having an impact. And I think we need to realize this and understand this deeply. We are being attacked by many different types of spiritual attitudes. We're being attacked from different directions by Satan the devil. And I think we can recognize we're being attacked in his devices, as he uses. Perhaps over some are trying to be swayed to follow a rebellious individual who has directly rebelled against his father, gone contrary to everything he said he would ever do, and some are being swayed that direction. Others are being swayed to just get upset generally because of Mr. Raider or alleged improprieties of other sorts. And Satan will use that to take those people out if they just want to let their minds be blown and go off for that in that direction. And then others may be taken away because they have liberal tendencies or doctrinal errors themselves, and that they want to, you know, follow a kind of a liberal way of life, and they don't want God's way of life that He's established in the church for the past 45 years under Herbert W. Armstrong, the anointed of God. And because they don't want that way of life, and they're constantly and have been subtly but persistently undermining that man, that blows their minds. And so they will say, well, you know, they know me, and I'm not going to change and decide to really follow from the heart what Mr. Armstrong says, so I'll get out. And all those pulls are going to be exerted on people, and perhaps other pulls from other directions, and other spirit personalities will be pulling and tugging at people to try to get them to leave the church of God, of which Jesus Christ is the living head. And I hope that none of you fall for those things. But there are those, and we're being attacked not just from one direction. And you're not being attacked from one direction. I'm talking not just about this current court thing. This is just a manifestation and an outgrowth of some of these people who are, of course, actually have encouraged and caused this to be, as you know, if you read the newspaper carefully, about what's really behind this court accusation that's come against us. So let's realize that although there may have been genuine improprieties in one or two directions, and I don't know that there were, but Satan could use that as the focal point, if you see what I mean, to cause everybody to get confused and go every which direction, and he could be clapping his hands and jumping with joy right now. Say, boy, I got him upset about this, and I got him upset about that, and now I'm going to get upset about this court trial and just blast them all. I'll lay them all out. And the way we can fool Satan the devil and beat him at his own game, so to speak, is if we really keep close to God in patience and humility, and have faith in the living Jesus Christ, and in humility and in purity and in patience, do purge out of God's work anything that's wrong in the area of doctrine or a way of life, and are willing to change and continue to change on that. Mr. Armstrong informed me again yesterday that he was certainly willing. He was willing to change on Pentecost. He was willing to change on DNR. He's willing to change on any genuine thing that can be found out, and always has been, and he will be. But not just to water down the whole way of life in a very obvious way that's totally wrong. And if there's something wrong in a financial area, why, we should change that. And we should root that out. Root and branch. And he said that he does want any improprieties to come out and those who perpetrated them to be punished. And we will take care of that. And if there have been other wrongs or grievances done individuals where they've been treated unjustly in any way, I hope and pray we can rectify that as best as we can and be sure that we do administer God's government in wisdom and in patience and in love and yet with proper firmness, because, you know, God does that too. He's not willy-nilly. He's going to put people in the lake of fire, and he opened up the whole earth, and Korah and his household went down, you know, the women and the little children screaming, and then God caused the earth to go and squash them. Now, God's not going to do that, and I'm not trying to scare anyone today. Some people, oh, you're trying to scare anyone. Would you, how many of you are scared of me right now? Anyway, you know, some people maybe are. But I am telling you to have the right kind of a fear of God, the awareness that He is alive, He is powerful, and He doesn't want us to be pushed here and there willy-nilly. We are to have firmness, too, but we are to have mercy and justice and wisdom and patience and all those things. And I know that with God's help, we will. So let's realize this. And that we do not want Satan the devil to have a field day. I'm sure you can agree with me in that. We do not want him to use these things to upset you or upset anyone in God's church, these little sheep, by taking advantage of these situations. Back in Hebrews, the 13th chapter, if you turn that back there with me. God says, verse 7, remember them who have the rule over you, who have spoken unto you the word of God, whose faith follow, considering the end of their conduct. We already considered that. But again, I can tell you, as we've told you before, and I know even some of those who've written and talked against Mr. Armstrong recently have had to affirm that they know that Mr. Armstrong has not had a hang-up with financial things and has not been off gathering money and has been reported by our financial people who even handle his account. He doesn't even handle his own bank account as being virtually broke. He has a few thousand dollars in the bank. By a few, I don't mean 100,000. I mean he has a few thousand, as I understand it, maybe a few tens. But someone told me it was under 50. And I mean that's his total cash, anything that he owns. You know, he doesn't have something in Switzerland or something here or there. And for the head of three corporations, an older man, have you ever noticed when a senator dies or a U.S. 93,000 or this or that a man might save as his estate for his children and his grandchildren as a just man is to lay up over the course of his life? Well, Mr. Armstrong just doesn't have it. All he has is his clothes, his personal effects. He doesn't even own his car, his house, or anything else, unless he has bought this house, perhaps for his wife in Tucson. I think he has done that. But he never did own his home here, and I've been in that house over there, and that is not near as big or near as nice as the one here. I can tell you that because I've been in it many, many times. It's a nice sort of Southern California or Southern Arizona style, I guess we should say there, a ranch-style house, and not a great, huge, fancy place in that sense at all. But anyway, Mr. Armstrong has served God faithfully so long, for so many, many years, that in God's work, and given up and sacrificed. And I've been there when Mrs. Mann and others were coming around trying to take up an offering because Mr. Armstrong and his wife put up their home for sale, were willing to move out, everything else. And I hope and pray that we can understand his loyalty and his dedication to God's work and back him as he follows Christ. I have a letter here, just something reporting something coming from Mr. Armstrong, but we'll see if it arrives. Now, God says, remember them who have the rule over you, who have spoken unto you the word of God, whose faith follow. And we are to follow their faith, and we are to be loyal to God and to his government, and that is the test at this time. It really is, brethren. Can you have faith in God's apostle and be following the one that God has put as his anointed all these years? Obey them that have the rule over you and submit yourselves, it says, for they watch for your souls as they that must give account, that they may do it with joy and not with grief, for that is unprofitable for you. So you are to submit yourselves and do it, you know, willingly and gladly and not with a lot of argument, because that makes it that much harder for God's servants if they have to operate under that kind of situation. Now, God's servants will always make some mistakes. You know, you read about Peter and how he, before he was really filled with God's Spirit, he cursed and denied Christ three times. And after even he was ordained and the leading apostle in the New Testament church, why he and Barnabas, he and Paul had this confrontation, and Paul confronted him over his lack of understanding of the racial issue that God was admitting all freely into God's church and spiritual fellowship, and had to be, you know, confronted. And then Paul and Barnabas, you know, had this confrontation, and the contention was so sharp between them, that they worked separately for a while and yet still cooperated and wrote lovingly, and obviously were still in the same work. They didn't start different churches, and they had a Paul church and a Barnabas church. They were going through the same churches, obviously, and commending one another to the same church. And so people will make mistakes, but they must still teach God's laws and do God's way. And that's exactly what Mr. Armstrong has continued to do. And I think you all know that deeply. He has never wavered from that. God has put them in office, and he is responsible to guide the church and responsible to guide them. And that is his responsibility. I know that I've had to realize that if there are mistakes, and there certainly are sometimes humanly because we're not perfect yet, you or I may not even know what the mistakes are. I've sometimes thought Mr. Armstrong was making a mistake in one area in a particular situation and found from the fruits years later that I was wrong, but he was maybe making a smaller mistake in a slightly different facet of that operation or something. You know what I mean? Because I didn't have all the facts, and I couldn't look back on it at the time. Hindsight is better than foresight, and we don't always realize that. So we've got to trust in Christ in that way. And I often have found out that Mr. Armstrong was far more right. In fact, not often, but I have to confess that his batting average has been much better than mine. And I know that. And that's why Christ has him there. In 1 Samuel 8, it came to pass when Samuel was old, he made his sons judges over Israel. His sons walked not in his ways, as you know, but took bribes, perverted judgment. And that was wrong. No question about that. Then all the elders of Israel gathered themselves and came to Samuel to Ramah. These elders, as I've explained in the employees meeting yesterday, they didn't come lovingly and patiently, one or two, humbly, saying, "Sir, we know you're God's servant, and we acknowledge that, and we appreciate that," and so on, "and we know you'll take care of that." They came as a great big group demanding, you see, "We want this, and we want it now." And that was what was wrong, their attitude, and more than that, the fact that they wanted to change the government of God, which was involved in this thing that came up recently, this court thing that was imposed on us temporarily. And they said, verse 5, "Behold, you're old, and your sons walk not in your ways. Now make us a king to judge us like all the nations." And so, you see, they wanted a change from God's working through one man as a prophet and a judge, where they wouldn't even have to have the expense of a standing army. And when some attacked, God would fight their battle. He would either destroy the enemy directly without any fighting at all, or if he let them fight, they would get together at the last minute, go out, maybe sometimes go out with bugles, not even with swords. Or if they had swords, he would cause them with a very few swords to whip a far larger army that had many more swords and many more weapons, because God was in it. And so they wanted to change that government of God. And the thing displeased Samuel, and he prayed to God, and the Eternal spoke to him directly, "Hearken to the voice of the people and all they say, for they have not rejected you, Samuel." They're not just rejecting a white-haired old patriarch there on earth, but they have rejected me, God said, that I should not reign over them. And brethren, I hope that we can understand that lesson. When we reject someone that God has put that way, the man that God has given all of us this knowledge through, the man that God has used, we are in fact rejecting God. And if God tells us to do something that's within God's law, you know what I mean? I don't want to follow Mr. Armstrong if he tells me to do something exactly contrary to God's law and outside of God's law. But if he tells me to do something within God's law that doesn't break the law of God, and he says, "We're going to have service at 1:30 rather than 2:30, or you're to do this, take a trip here, or go there and raise up a church, and I don't think it's time, or fire this man, or hire this other man, or something," well, I should say, "Well, Mr. Armstrong, sir, you know, I'd like to talk to you about it, if I might," and try to talk to him, or if I don't have time to talk to him right then, do it, and then hopefully get it changed or modified later, if the situation is that way, but not rebel against him, because he is God's apostle. Back in 1 Samuel 24, a very classic case, you know the story how Saul went out with 3,000 men to look for David, and because I've given it recently, and I don't want to overdwell on these, but I think this is a crisis thing, and some of you weren't here the other day, and I know many were, but at any rate, I want to give you this. They came out to look for David. And David knew that Saul was yet in that office, even though he was supposed to be the next king. So Saul went into the cave to relieve himself, and David's men said, "Kill him now. Now you got him. Now you got him. Kill him." And David, of course, did cut off the robe, the corner of Paul's robe, quietly, you know, just to have something to wave and say, "See, I close to got to killing you." But he did not kill him, and even cutting off part of his garment, made him feel guilty later, and he repented. He said, I should not have done it. And that's right. To dishonor in that way this man, as long as he was in that office, and it was up to God to take care of it. And he should not have even done that. And he said to his men, verse 6, the Eternal forbid that I should do this thing to my master. The Eternal's anointed to stretch forth my hand against him, seeing he is the anointed of the Eternal. And Mr. Armstrong is the anointed of God. And I don't have some hysterical attitude about that, and I don't think you do either. He's not some man that's going to tell us all to rush off a cliff or go do this or that, like some people have tried to grossly exaggerate in recent times. And all of us know that, who've had that man in our homes, and we've been in his homes and seen that he's a basic, sound-minded, dedicated, loving, thoughtful, wise, businessman-type individual, as far as just a sound-minded, practical approach to things. And that's why he has been able to be used of God in our business-like commercial society to do a job, because he is that type of man. And he's not some hysterical individual. He has facts. He tries to get all the facts, and then he tries to make a decision. And that's the way he operates. A little later in chapter 26, 1 Samuel 26, you read again about King David. This man after God's own heart. This man had a heart like God. And here was his attitude. Again, Saul was trying to kill him on another expedition. And David said, let's go down to Saul's camp. And he got his nephew, great, big, powerful nephew, the son of Abishai, who was the son of David's sister. And this young man came down with him. And verse 7, as it says, and they came right to where Abner and the people were sleeping. Saul and Abner, his captain, were sleeping, and God caused a deep sleep, obviously, to come on them, so they didn't even wake up. And so verse 8, then Abishai, this young warrior, said to David, God has delivered your enemy into your hand this day. Now, therefore, let me smite him, I pray, with a spear, even to the earth at once. He said, let me get one spear into him. It won't take more than that. I'll just nail him in one fell swoop. And David said, destroy him not, for who can stretch forth his hand against the Eternal's anointed and be guiltless? And, brethren, that is a lesson we really deeply need to learn. Those who rise up and try to fight or go off, you know, and start a competing work or do anything like that against God and His anointed. Because we're in a spiritual warfare. We say, well, they haven't killed Mr. Armstrong. No, but a lot of people have resisted him. They've fought him within the organization in a wrong way. They've tried to undermine him. They've tried to circumvent him. And then they've gone outside and established their own church to fight this church. And much of their effort, directly in their broadcast, their literature, is directly aimed, because they talk about you church people, and they make sure all of us people get it. They don't go off to some neutral city where we may not even have a broadcast and start up something completely different and unrelated. No, they're here to prove themselves that they were right, after all, and that Mr. Armstrong was wrong. That's a lot of the psychological mechanism that is involved, to make themselves feel justified in what they did. And so they are fighting against God and His anointed. Who can stretch forth His hand against God's anointed and be guiltless? And David said, as the Eternal lives, the Eternal shall smite him, or his day shall come to die. God will take care of him. You know, as I've said, brethren, if I shouldn't be here, I hope that God will remove me, because I don't want to be a problem to myself or to you or to God. I really don't. And I hope all of you feel the same way, from the greatest to the least. And we've got to have that attitude as servants of God. God will take care of him. He'll die in battle or whatever and perish. The Eternal forbid that I should stretch forth my hand, he repeated, against God's anointed. So this was David's attitude, the man after God's own heart. I hope and pray all of us can be after God's own heart in that way. Because in a time of trial and test, in a time of crisis, in a time of battle, perhaps we should take time to consider, well, let's do it nicely and let's do it cleanly and all this and that. But if the fort is under storm, if the fort is under siege by an enemy, we can't always do all that right now. Within God's law, and I have to say that, of course, but within God's law, then the main commodity that's necessary as a human characteristic becomes what? One word, loyalty. Loyalty to the government of God. That is the main commodity. As long as you already know it's God's church, as long as you know that whatever you're being asked to do and what Mr. Armstrong is doing is within God's law. You may not understand every detail of it, but it's within God's law, and He continues to do God's work. And in a crisis situation where things are going like this and that, what is the one thing God does expect of you and look to you for more than anything else? Loyalty. It really is, brethren, and I hope you can realize that and meditate on that deeply. Back in 1 Chronicles, I'd like to turn back to 1 Chronicles 11. Finally, after all these internecine conflicts that David had first with Saul, and then finally some of the people split off under some of Saul's sons, you know, in Israel, and Saul or David was made king of Judah only, and finally they got it all together in 1 Chronicles 11 and decided to bring David back as king over all Israel. And they made a covenant with him, even the Israelites, and verse 3, anointed David king over Israel according to the word of the Eternal by Samuel. Samuel said he's going to be king over all Israel. But he wasn't for a while, you know. He looked for a while like he wasn't. First Saul kept him from it, almost killed him, and then the Israelites rebelled and they wouldn't yield to him for 7 years. He still didn't do what God said. Oh, it's never going to happen. Well, finally it did happen, and he was made king over all Israel. And David and all Israel went to Jerusalem, which is Jebus, where the Jebusites were, the inhabitants of the land. And verse 5, the inhabitants of Jebus said to David, "You shall not come hither." These were rebellious Gentile types, whatever it was. It didn't matter of their race, but their attitude. And they said that you're not going to come in here. And somehow the previous people of that city had let them have that attitude and keep that particular area, which was apparently the best for the palace and the fort and all of that. And so they would not want David to do that. And David said, "Whosoever smite the Jebusites first shall be chief and captain." In other words, if you want to be the head of my army, each one of you, and I suppose he was talking to his battalion commanders, as we might say today, you know, whoever wants to be in charge, you be the one that takes this area. So Joab, the son of Zeruiah, Joab was Abishai's brother. David had these two big, powerful nephews here from his big sister. Maybe big in more ways than one, who knows. But she had two big, powerful sons, and they were loyal to Uncle David. So Joab, the son of Zeruiah, went up first. He conquered that area, which David wanted as his castle, and he became chief. And as you know the story, he later was the commanding general of the armies of Israel. And David dwelt in the castle, therefore they called it the city of David. He built it up, and Joab repaired the rest of the city. So David waxed greater and greater, for the Lord of hosts was with him. God was with him, as he yielded to God as a human leader over a carnal nation. These are also the chief of the mighty men whom David had. He's been telling about these men and the mighty things they did, and loyalty to David. You see, Joab showed that loyalty under crisis. He risked his life. He risked the lives of his men. He conquered this enemy when the king said to do so. And so these are these chief men whom David had, who strengthened themselves with him in his kingdom and with all Israel to make him king according to the word of the Lord concerning Israel. And then it begins to list the mighty men of King David. Well, brethren, I hope all of us want to strengthen ourselves with Mr. Armstrong and strengthen ourselves with Jesus Christ and strengthen ourselves with our Father by showing loyalty in a time of crisis, because that's what we're in and this is the situation that we're facing right now. So let's do that and let's really have that attitude. Back in Matthew, the 12th chapter, Matthew 12, we read about something that happened to our nation and could be happening to God's church if we did not have the leadership of Jesus Christ. Matthew 12, and let's begin in verse 25. When the Pharisees heard Jesus was casting out demons, they said, "This fellow does not cast out demons, but by Beelzebub, the prince of the demons." They wouldn't even acknowledge that what he did was coming from God, even though it was all this power. And Jesus knew their thoughts and said to them, "Every kingdom divided against itself is brought to desolation, and every city or house divided against itself shall not stand. And if Satan cast out Satan, he is divided against himself. How then shall his kingdom stand? Because Satan has a kingdom, he has a government." But the message here is that everything, every institution, every house, every nation, every church that is divided against itself cannot stand. And brethren, if we allow ourselves to be bitter, to be upset, to be accusative in a wrong way of the decisions of Jesus Christ through his apostle, at a time, not bringing it up loyally and patiently and helpfully and all that, but in a way that creates hysteria, in a way that creates division, then we, of course, are obvious, direct contributors to that division. And we've got to try not to do that, but to be loyal and not try to second-guess Mr. Armstrong in the government of God. We do not want a house divided, and we must not have that kind of house, and I'm sure with your attitudes, we will not. Another little word of caution along that line. back in Proverbs, the 13th chapter, Proverbs chapter 13. I'm keeping you over a little bit because I started so late. We had two previous speakers, and also you'll understand in a minute. I just got a note here that something else should be arriving. Proverbs 13, verse 3. He that keeps his mouth keeps his life, but he that opens wide his lips shall have destruction. And brethren, I think of all times, this is a time to give very careful consideration to what you say. You know, it's not just what you say, but also how you say it, the inflection in your voice, the way you raise your eye. Yeah, well, yeah, we heard that, you know, this type of thing. Does that attitude create loyalty? Does it create support for God and God's work and Mr. Armstrong, God's apostle? Or does it tend to tear down and destroy and minimize and undermine the government of God and the loyalty toward the servant that God has placed? I think that's something to really think about. It says in verse 10, only by pride comes contention, but with well-advised is wisdom. So we don't want to have pride and vanity. So anyway, we do need to be very careful what we say and how we say it in this particular regard. And I hope that you all will. One other caution, I'd like to read this one other scripture here and perhaps cut this a little short because of circumstances now. This thing has arrived. Proverbs 24. Proverbs 24. Even though something else is here, you can still listen to me, can't you? Proverbs 24, verse 10. If you faint in the day of adversity, your strength is small. If you forbear to deliver them that are drawn to death and those ready to be slain, if you say, behold, we didn't know it, we didn't realize this nation was about to be swallowed up and we were supposed to be together and not fighting each other, but getting this work of God out, and we got so absorbed with our own vanity that we weren't willing to give our being to the work of God, that God says to me, at least, as I understand this, that I'm going to be held accountable for that. Because there are a lot of people outside this church that need our help. And they really do need our help, brethren. In the name of Christ, I tell you, they need our help, and we've got to get this work going. And if we spend all of our time accusing Mr. Armstrong and judging and second-guessing him and causing divisions, how are we ever going to get this work done? I hope we can understand that. So let's not do that. There are people out here, they're about to die, they're about to enter into the greatest trouble, they're about to be drawn to death in the greatest time of tribulation in human history. And if we say, we didn't understand that, we didn't grasp what was happening, we didn't get it, well, God says, does not he that ponders the heart consider it? And he that keeps your soul, doesn't he know it? And shall not he render to every man according to his works? Our actions and our words and our works over the next several days especially are going to show God where a lot of us stand and whether we are willing to trust Mr. Armstrong and his judgment and his wisdom in these affairs and whether or not we, as God's true servants, are willing to have faith in the leadership of Christ and stand fast in a time of trial and a time of test and a time of siege in the work of God. So let's do that, brethren, and let's show loyalty in every way to Mr. Armstrong and to God's government. I want now to read something that I've been assured by Mr. Luker, and I'm so glad that he's the one that gave it to me under this circumstance, because I just happen to know him a little better than the rest of you, most of you, not all of you. But this is a letter signed by Mr. Armstrong, and the ink is fresh, I say. It's not some printed thing. And I didn't know what was coming. I tell you, before God and Christ, I had no idea anything was coming until this thing came up that I'm going to have to, I see skimming this, do something that I've just been preaching to you. And I will do it. So he directs this letter to me in my office and says, Dear Rod, this is to inform you, dated the other day, and it's gotten here now with his signature, and to confirm the decision I have made this day to disfellowship from the Worldwide Church of God and all its related organizations for cause. I see he doesn't spend 15 minutes trying to convince me that he has the right to be the apostle or convince you, so I guess we'll have to have a little faith in Christ and in Mr. Armstrong. The following. And so you listen carefully. And all of you, as you know, are forbidden to associate with and to eat with or fellowship with. And if you're really loyal, you're not going to go out and commiserate with, you know, people and try to say, oh, well, let's all be the underdog and yak it up and try to judge God's apostle. But these people are disfellowshipped by Mr. Herbert Armstrong directly and by me personally, as I have to do it in my responsibility. And I'm sorry I've come into this office in a time of siege, perhaps. Maybe it had to be. I'll just tell you that in advance. It would be so much nicer to come in a real peaceful time rather than warfare. But we are in war. Let's see whether we are faithful warriors. The fellow following men are to be disfellowshipped this day. Mr. C. Wayne Cole, Mr. David Antion, Robert Kuhn, and Benjamin Chapman. Now, I know in two or three of these cases very good reasons already where it would have to have been done in the next day or two anyway. One or two I did not know to the same degree, but I had lots of intimations. But I don't think he intends for me to explain that. I understand that Mr. Rader is here and is going to explain some of that to you directly from Mr. Armstrong. I further instruct you to mark these men before the church for causing division and offenses contrary to the doctrine they and the church has learned, and to avoid them according to Romans 6:17. We're to mark them and avoid them, Romans 6:17. And so we're to do this in the interest of doctrinal and administrative peace within the church of God. Sincerely, in Jesus' name, Herbert W. Armstrong. And so now I'd like to introduce Mr. Rader and ask him to explain for Mr. Armstrong. I'm going to stand here with him because I share this responsibility and may wish to make some final comments. But I'm going to ask Mr. Rader then, as I understand he's here, to come on out and explain to you why Mr. Armstrong has chosen to make these decisions. Mr. Stanley Rader.
Greetings, everyone. This has been a very eventful week, and if I can do no more today than to make you realize what almost happened, but for the grace and the will of God, I will have accomplished a great deal today. Now, what happened this week was something that was fairly well predicted by Mr. Armstrong in May of 1978. And for the past 8 months, maybe 7 months, I guess, he has been watching very carefully, has been weighing the conduct of all of us, what we've been saying, what we've been doing, our overt acts, and the like. He has not been inaccessible. He has been reached by hundreds of people, by telephone, by letter, and in person. And he has had to weigh and sift through all that he has been made aware of during that period of time, as well as the impressions and the knowledge that he had gained in some 46 years as Christ's apostle. During that particular period of time, I had done everything I could to slow things down, hoping that Mr. Armstrong this time was not right, hoping that what he had predicted was happening and would continue to happen would in fact not happen. And I had, during that period of time, in person and in writing, on more than one occasion, I have defended Mr. Cole to the point that I had to come to harsh words with Mr. Armstrong. I defended Mr. Kuhn as recently as 6 weeks ago when he ordered me to fire him that moment. And I resisted. And he told me that he thought that I had forgotten that he was Christ's apostle. He had given me an order. And I said, Mr. Armstrong, let me give him another chance. He said, you are making another mistake. I'm telling you to fire him. Now, this was after 4 days of argument by telephone and by an exchange of letters between me and Mr. Armstrong over Dr. Kuhn, with Mr. Armstrong telling me to fire him and my trying to defend him. And Mr. Armstrong telling me, I'm telling you again, Stan, you are wrong. Why I did it, I don't know, but I thought maybe he was entitled to another chance. But Mr. Armstrong, obviously, once again knew better. The man standing on my left will tell you that there's never any question about where I stand. I had heard, I still don't know whether it's true, and I don't care. But I had heard from another man in the ministry whom I had learned to respect and whom I had learned to admire and whom I had spent a considerable period of time with in Mr. Armstrong's company during the past 2 years. I've been informed that Mr. Meredith had slandered me. And I was in New York. And I guess I'd had a hard day. And I didn't want to make believe that I was someone other than myself. So I picked up the telephone. I tried to get Mr. Meredith, and I couldn't get him. He called me back, and I blew my top. Really. He can tell you that. I mean... and the next day, I blew my top even more. But Mr. Meredith said, he didn't remember saying what he said. If he said it, he apologized. I said, fine, I accept the apology. I called Mr. Armstrong. I said, no problem. I don't care whether he said it, and I'll never be able to prove whether he did or he didn't. It doesn't make any difference, does it? But I got it off my chest. I had apologized, but it was all through. I felt worse, having lost my cool, as they say, because I really was pretty angry, right? I think more angry the second day. More angry the second day than the first day. And we had a minister.
King David was Jewish, and he got angry, too. We've been reading about him. Right.
Then Mr. Cole, some time ago, right after the Feast of Tabernacles, called a ministerial meeting. I didn't know why exactly, but I checked around a little bit, and he'd said he'd heard some reports about certain ministers making comments during the feast that were divisive. And I sat in that meeting, and I said, every man in this room, I have had occasion to defend on more than one occasion where efforts had been made to discredit them in Mr. Armstrong's eyes, and that I was serving notice on all of them, that I don't care who it was. If someone went to Mr. Armstrong ex parte and tried to discredit that person in his eyes, I at least was going to throw up a resistance that would allow that person to get a chance to get to Mr. Armstrong. Remember my saying that, Mr. Meredith. And there was a lot going on that day. There was quite a dialogue, kind of colloquy. And you could see people of different points of view, basically on doctrine and church government. And that's all this is about. If this church doesn't have government and doesn't have a unity on doctrine, then it isn't God's church. But I wasn't getting involved in that. I was just serving warning on everybody that if they expected to blow somebody out of the saddle with Mr. Armstrong ex parte, I didn't care who it was, I was going to offer a defense till that person could get to Mr. Armstrong with the facts. So all of this was going on. In the meantime, in October, right after the Feast of Tabernacles, I told Mr. Armstrong that I felt that it would still be in the best interests of the work if within a reasonable period of time, sometime perhaps in January, if I could pick up my duties that I had before May and serve Him more adequately in a role that I was more comfortable with. And that letter I wrote with a little pique. I was a little bit annoyed. I'd heard somebody had told Mr. Armstrong that I was running the work and that he was beginning to believe it. So I was a little annoyed because I didn't care if everyone thought I was running the work. He knew it wasn't true and I knew it wasn't true. But on this occasion, somebody said that he thought it was true. Well, of course, he knew it wasn't, and he cooled me off and we let it rest. In November, about a week or so, I think it was about November 16th, about a week or so before Thanksgiving and again before our departure for the Middle East, I wrote Mr. Armstrong again, and then he wrote to the pastors, and I think we published some of the comments in the pastor's report and in the Worldwide News, that I was beginning to kind of have it up to here with the problems of trying to be a day-by-day administrator, which I didn't like, and also people setting me up as a possible alternative to him in the event something happened to him, if God, for some reason or other, were not to allow him to complete the work that had been delegated to him as Christ's apostle. And again, Mr. Armstrong and I talked it over, and we thought that it was a bit premature. And then, shortly before the first of the year, before New Year's, we had another discussion on the telephone. It's kind of an interesting discussion, because on a particular Thursday, just prior to New Year's Day, a Mr. Wayne Cole, C. Wayne Cole, had gone down to Mr. Armstrong, and in writing and under a lot of pressure, had told him a couple of very interesting things. One, that he was absolutely certain that a lawsuit was going to be filed immediately after New Year's. And gave him a letter which concerned me, the essence of which I will read you, because Mr. Armstrong excerpted certain paragraphs in a letter he wrote back to me dated January 1. And the sum and substance of the pressure, you see, was to find a way before the lawsuit began for me to step down as treasurer. Because if that were possible, if I were off someplace in Japan on a trip and the events of this past week occurred, the battle would be over. Because the CBS said, and we have the tape, may we'll show it, I'm a fighter. And I'm going to fight for Mr. Herbert Armstrong. And we found out in the last 72 hours we have a lot of fighters. Because I couldn't have done it alone. Mr. Helge and I couldn't have done it together without the people who worked with us for almost 72 consecutive hours. We were blocked out of our offices. We were blocked from our files. But our lawyers turned over their offices to us and their manpower and their secretaries. And when it got too late for them to continue, they left the building and just left us in control of their entire office. And we were making calls all over the world for information. They weren't worried about who was going to pay the bill for the long distance calls and what have you. But see, we were locked out. At any rate, they wanted to see if there was some way to get me out before the lawsuit hit. And they also had some very uncomplimentary things to say about another individual named Helge. Because, you see, he'd throw up quite a bit of resistance also. Now, the letter that Mr. Armstrong wrote was written to me 48 hours after we had a little argument on the phone. apparently what they had told Mr. Armstrong was bothering him a little bit. And he happened to call in on a Sunday. And there's one person working in the administration building that day. Happened to be Virginia Keniston. She just happened to be working there that day. And he had called in. See, he doesn't remember too well that Sunday's a day of rest. And as far as he was concerned, he had just finished writing another article and he was going to dictate it to somebody. And he got her on the phone. After he got finished working with her, she made a mistake. Apparently, she said to him, "By the way, Mr. Armstrong, the cover for The Plain Truth, February number, was delivered here Friday." And out of the clear blue sky, he exploded. Because you see, Mr. Cole had told him that Mrs. Keniston was selecting the covers for the Plain Truth magazine. Because see, it wasn't enough to say I was running the work. That portion that I wasn't running, obviously Mrs. Keniston was running. And she came over to my house in the afternoon, and that was New Year's, the day of New Year's Eve, the 31st. It was a Sunday, I guess that's, yeah, New Year's is a Monday, wasn't it? And she came over in tears. And I felt that she had been unfairly attacked. And I called Mr. Armstrong and I did the unforgivable again. I again blew my top. But Mr. Armstrong is pretty accustomed to that. And he knows that I don't have anything in mind that is really disrespectful of him as authority, but I get off my chest, and I guess that means I won't have an ulcer. And when we got all through, he had said he didn't know why Mrs. Keniston was upset. And then he said, "Well, I guess I said more than I should have, and I should tell her that it was quite all right, and he didn't mean it," and so on. But I could tell, and he could tell, there were things under the surface. So I sent him another letter telling him that the more I thought about it, the more I felt that my feelings of the past 8 months, which were becoming a little bit more acute in the last quarter of the year, were such that within a reasonable period of time, I would want to go back to doing what we were doing before as his chief advisor, traveling with him, the foundation, and helping in the legal and financial end of things. And he said, "Well, we'll talk about that later. There's no rush. But Stan, you may be more right than wrong." Next day was New Year's. And that was a Monday. And then the following day was Tuesday, which of all days was the day before the Wednesday when all this other activity began. And Mel Olinger rang my doorbell that evening at about 9 o'clock, I believe. And I'd like to read this letter with you because it will show you just how Mr. Armstrong and I deal with one another openly, although we don't often share the letters that we write to one another. But this says, "Dear Stan, dated January 1. He had written it on New Year's Day, but he prayed about it, as he told me, and he didn't have it sent in with Mel until Tuesday. He didn't want to send it in by the machine, the quip machine that we had, because he wanted to be a private letter to me. This is what he said. "Dear Stan, I regret exceedingly having triggered the violent emotional outburst," that's putting it mildly, "over the telephone last evening. Our personal relations together through the years have been too pleasant, stimulating, and rewarding, and based on mutual esteem, loyalty, and trust, to let anything come between us. I'll certainly do my best to prevent any such outburst in the future." So once again, he let me off the hook because he didn't really say anything to me that should have made me go into orbit. What he had said to my secretary, and he caught the flack, and I, of course, apologized. He goes on, "I had been considerably distraught by things brought to my attention or I should not have spoken so emphatically to Virginia. As I said on the phone, I'm deeply sorry. Things have been brought to my attention that seriously threaten the very life of God's church and work. I feel I must now candidly bring it to you. If ever I needed your help, Stan, it is now. You have been a faithful help to me in the work that no one else could have contributed. Ted has been playing overtime on the rift between himself and you. I told you last spring that I felt I could come more effectively to your defense after I got the church turned around and had built back my own credibility. I did accomplish that. And sincerely, Stan, I'm sure that feelings that may have been aroused against your integrity, honor, and loyalty have now disappeared. And I will continue to defend your good name as do you mine. But from a number of coordinators and field ministers, as well as from Pasadena, I've learned that definitely the following situation does now exist, which could prove fatal to the work unless cleared before the ministers' conference. I have the following report from the Office of Pastoral Administration. Quote, quite frankly, Mr. Armstrong, a very large number of members and ministers see only two choices for the future. That's all underscored for emphasis. The words themselves, you see, were not emphatic enough. These two choices are Ted and Stan. Though many, most actually, don't want to leave you and follow Ted, they see the only alternative as following Stan, and they'd rather see Ted lead the church than Stan. Continuing to quote, to reinforce this attitude in the minds of our people, Stan is doing everything he can to present himself as next in line, underscored, under you to run the work. In a purely physical way, it is common knowledge that Stan did not allow very much time to pass after Ted's departure from his office before he, Stan, moved in. That office is part of the executive suite. It is seen as a, quote, symbol, unquote, the place for the man next to you in authority. Stan uses the underground garage, and he uses your private elevator. It is a very common belief that very few, if any, people can get to you. This is the irony of error. Very few, if any, people can get to you to talk to you privately without going through Stan. Mr. Armstrong, I could go on and on. But why? My point is that Stan and his prominent position in the work is causing many people to stumble. Underscore. This causes offense. God's word says that we who are converted and have a godly love for our fellow man will suffer even wrongly, unjustly. Last words underscore, which I agree. The Apostle Peter said, what reward is it when you suffer for things deserved? Question mark. But one is humble, is like a little child. He is willing and ready to suffer wrong rather than give unnecessary cause for offense and stumbling to others. End quote. Stan, I know you have done these things. Stan, I know you have done these things to help and serve the work and to help me. I love you as a son, as you well know. I have accepted such things as moving into Ted's former office as trying to most efficiently serve the work. But actually, the letter quoted above is mild compared to things I have heard from other sources. Certainly, none of it is in any reflection on your integrity. That's all in caps of Mr. Armstrong. I don't hear any more of reflections against your good character. But I do hear that people believe you are pushing your way in to take over. But no matter how false, God says we should avoid even the appearance of wrong and avoid causing little ones to stumble. Even though I do not feel as if I were over 45 years of age, people do look at that 86 plus figure. And most people do feel that anyone past 60 is old. And past 70 is sure to die any moment. I know and you know that I will go on living as long as God needs and wants me to live. But the little ones out there seem unable to see that. I know, Stan, that this is the general attitude and view of the ministry and brethren generally around the country. I've been assured of it from coordinators and ministers from widely scattered areas. And although I think we have cleared any false charges against your personal integrity, they do look on you as an attorney, familiar with finance and business, and not as a shepherd over God's flock. So what I propose is this, that we go back to the status as it was prior to Ted's departure, that you resign from administrative responsibilities in the church and the college, but continue as vice president, executive vice president for the foundation, as my personal assistant and advisor, as our auditor, CPA, and legal counsel, and of course, perhaps most important of all, continue with me in the Great Commission overseas. It might even look better for the church to pay you an annual retainer for legal counsel, financial advisor, etc., subject to additional billing where warranted, and the foundation to pay you also a salary or fee as you think best. I do want you and need you, in caps, to continue as my personal assistant and advisor, especially in projects such as our overseas and marketing of my books. Stan, I believe this will remove the last remaining serious threat to the work of the Great Commission. I know that if we do what Christ leaves for us to do, and as I know he has led me in the above, the living Christ will preserve his church and work, will bless you and me and all in the church, and lead us to gloriously finish the Great Commission. With deepest love in Jesus' name. I picked up the phone that evening, told Mr. Armstrong, of course, I was in complete accord. And we discussed the person that we would bring back to fill the office that I would resign from. And we settled on Mr. Brown, Frank Brown, who for years had been here. I had helped train him. And we had agreed that we'd probably make the announcement sometime during the ministerial conference or at the time of an annual board meeting. And then the next morning was Wednesday. So they almost got away with it. But just like I said at the Feast of Tabernacles, God kept Mr. Armstrong alive to see what the work would be like if he hadn't taken the steps vis-a-vis his son. And once again, God stepped in and showed Mr. Armstrong who would have tried to seize power if he were not around to stop it. Now, what happened this week can perhaps be best summed up by an analogy, if it weren't for all of what I've just discussed, the background leading up to it, Mr. Armstrong's concerns that were of 7 or 8 months duration. But for that background, we could have summed it up a little differently. If this had just been a vicious effort on the part of a few disgruntled people coupled by an extraordinarily harsh, unnecessary, and unjustifiable action on the part of the state, backed up by the courts, Satan's courts, Mr. Armstrong has called them, the unjust judges and what have you. If it had just been that, nothing more, no background, then we could describe it a little bit like the situation that obtained in Europe during the Second World War. And in Nazi-occupied territories, those of you who studied history, you will know that there were people who were collaborators. Now, they might not have wanted to invite the Nazis in, so they might not have been the fifth column type of individual. They might not have been guilty of the seditious conduct. They might not have been guilty of espionage and what have you. But once the Germans were in power, some people liked it. Some people thought they would never be rid of the Germans, and they thought it'd be better to collaborate. Now, that's pretty much what happened here on the very second day, I guess it was, of the events of this week. I guess it was Thursday. Because the first action on the part of the receiver, and it's extraordinary because he was temporarily appointed, ex parte, no notice given to anybody. First thing he did is to announce that Mr. Armstrong was fired and Mr. Rader was fired. And then he turned to Mr. Cole and he appointed Mr. Cole as acting head of the church. Now, anybody who would accept such an appointment, acting or otherwise, would have to be characterized in euphemistic terms as a collaborator. If I had been here and that man had turned to me and said, Mr. Armstrong was fired and you, Mr. Rader, acting, I would have said, you're ridiculous. You can't appoint me. No one can take away Mr. Armstrong's authority as Christ's apostle, as his personal representative on this earth at this time. Nobody. And certainly you, an unbaptized, unconverted person, could never appoint me or anybody to run this church. Now, that's all there was to it. If that had not happened, we might have been in greater difficulty. If Mr. Cole had not accepted, we might have had a tougher time in court yesterday. But the judge saw through it very clearly. Mr. Herbert W. Armstrong is Christ's apostle as far as that judge is concerned, just as we know he is. And he has been given the court's official recognition as the man in charge, the man who hires and fires, the man who ordains and disfellowships. No receiver is going to sit here as he did for several days and intimidate our people and tell our people that his name is going to appear on our checks. No. That's not going to happen either. So, as I said, it could be summed up just that easily, but for the fact that there was this history. Without the history, it might have simply been opportunism. Maybe some people do think Mr. Armstrong's over the hill. Maybe he's right when he says everybody thinks anybody over 60 is old and past 70 is sure to die any minute. But I'm going to share something with you And that is, he said he's going to execute that letter, disfellowshipping the four people that Mr. Meredith just announced before he falls over and drops dead. So that's what he thought about it. He told me yesterday at 2:05, that he had made that decision. And I told him I was on my way to court. I said, don't worry about it. God is on his throne. And when I got out of court that day, I called him and I said, you were right. God is on his throne. So I think it's going to be a better church in the future. I think we're going to have unity. We're going to have a ministry that's not divided. We're going to have church government as it was here up until about 10 years ago. And we're all going to know what the doctrines are, and we're all going to agree, and we're going to have a renewed faith and a rebirth. Now, I'm a little tired. I want to tell you a little bit more about the events, but Mr. Helge is there, and he's tired too. He just came back from Tucson as well. I'd like him to fill in. I asked him if he would please take a few notes on the things that I might have omitted concerning the events of this past few days. And I know you'll bear with us because I think you'd like to have it given to you in 1, 2, 3, 4 order. So, Mr. Helge, could I call on you now to say a few words? Thank you. Oh, excuse me. I almost forgot. The main reason I had to read this, besides the background, is that as much as I would like to get on to doing those things which I know I can do best, and as much as Mr. Armstrong and I had planned that I'd be able at an early time to resign, until this entire matter is over, until the lawsuit has been smashed, and it will be, and until the Attorney General has decided that we are what we are, an institution of integrity of 46 years vintage, I must remain in office because I must be in a position to protect the work and to protect Mr. Armstrong. So although Mr. Meredith was quite right when he said, because I called him this morning at 7 o'clock and explained to him that I explained to him that I wanted to let him know precisely what had happened in court yesterday, and to let him know that Mr. Armstrong and I had been discussing, as I knew Mr. Armstrong had mentioned to him, that I would be resigning. It will not, unfortunately, be in the very, very near future, because I do expect procedurally there will be a lot of things for us to work out before we crush the opposition. And believe me, we will. Mr. Helge and I have never lost a case for this, never, and we're not going to start with this one. So those of you who are unhappy that I have that title of treasurer, well, I'll try to make you a little happier, and I am not running the work. I'm defending it. I've always tried my hardest to do that, and Mr. Helge and I will be in there pitching with the others to put these people to rout. And one thing is, Mr. Armstrong and I agreed today, we don't sue people by attacking them first. But boy, when they attack us, then they find out what kind of ball game they're in. So now it's a changed ball game. And all those people that have been taking the pot shots at us with impunity, they're going to find that it's a different game. And we're all armed with the whole armor of God. And I think you will find that God's work will prevail. But Mr. Helge, can you fill them in a 1, 2, 3, 4 step manner so they understand a little bit more thoroughly what has happened?
All right.
Good. Thank you. Thank you.
Strange. I was just kissing for Mr. Meredith there, saying there's no need for me to speak because it'd just be anticlimactic after what was said. At that time, Mr. Rader said, step out. Then as I did, Mr. Meredith said, they've been here for 3 hours, so make it very, very short. So I'm in a little bit of a dilemma how I can cut it short, because believe me, we can only convey to you what has taken place. I was out in Tucson on a case, and I'm leaving Tucson walking in the airport, and the case is one in which we're trying to prevent some man that is being charged with extortion from bringing in Mr. Herbert Armstrong just so he can malign the church. And I'm buzzed on the receiver. Mr. Helge, pick up the phone. And I pick up the phone, and I hear a frantic voice say, What am I going to do? They're banging on the door. They want all the files. They want everything in here. And that happened to be Virginia Keniston. Now, whatever limitations Virginia Keniston may have, I'll tell you, I have learned to come to admire her stamina and the way she held out. Because they were banging on the door, and they were threatening to take the files, and they were threatening to put everybody in jail and to arrest everybody. And they held out there. And I'll tell you, I could see it was a battle. If I could just bring the point home that we are fighting Satan, this is a battle. And I mean a fight. If you only can go back and look into the Bible and believe the fact that there's a Satan, and renew your faith not only in God, but in the fact that there's a Satan, and he is fighting us. I've been trying to write an article to refute certain rumors, and I wanted to go ahead and use that as the heart and core of it. I don't want to get off on a tangent here. I just want to stay on what I've been instructed to go on. It's going to be hard to do. Well, anyway, there was a banging on the door. I tell you, I just don't know how I can limit this. I want to cut down, but just a few things I want to say here. There's so many in my heart and my mind. I tell you, we've been awake consistently now, maybe for 3 days, with only a couple hours sleep, trying to fight this battle. And then when I come here, there's a misunderstanding outside, and that made me feel all the worse, but it was only a misunderstanding, because all the feelings and tensions are running very high. But I tell you, they're settled down, and God is in his throne on heaven, and there are so many things we could tell as the way he made things work here. I'll tell you, you wouldn't believe them. Maybe I'll have the time some other time to go through some of them. Well, what occurred here was, at that point, we came back, we found that a suit had been filed, and certain people had gone out and had themselves appointed under the Attorney General. This Attorney General happened to be one that was a deputy, at the bottom of the rung, that was rather antagonistic to us. He called me one time, and I can tell just by the tone of his voice, he read something in a paper and was just a little bit embittered. So they got to him, and he took certain steps that he said, okay, I will kind of give you authority. So it looks as though the state attorney general is doing it. You see, so the people of California, my question constantly is, if there has been a wrong done, why do you pick dissidents from the church, disfellowship church members, to come and file the suit? Why don't you, attorney general, have enough guts to do it yourself? Why didn't you do it, you see? That's a question that has to be answered. Then what happened was, they took these documents. They go to court. And they sold the court on something that I tell you I had heard in rumor from Mr. Frank Brown. And you know what I told Mr. Brown? I says, whoever told you that could happen is a liar. You go back and tell him he's a liar. That could never be done in the courts here. He said, well, I tell you what. Then I had another call from him. He said, I tell you, I heard it again. Could you at least check it out? I says, I wouldn't even dignify it by checking out. It could never happen. But it did happen. And I'll tell you, if you walk down, I don't feel ashamed of that opinion, because you walk down any street here, you talk to every attorney, and they will tell you it is impossible to have happen. But again, I'll tell you, there's a Satan, and he's got power to sway men's minds. And that's what they did. And they went into court, and even though the court rules say, if you're going to come in and try to have any action taken against anybody, you must call them a minimum of 4 hours' notice, so they can at least come in and explain what you're going to do. Now, what they asked for was, in every piece of law I checked, said was the most extreme, impossible remedy that could ever be given to anybody, and that's to have somebody appointed to walk in and take charge of everything. I mean buildings, assets, records, everything owned, and run it. Something that the law says is so far beyond our Constitution and our means of law that you just virtually can never hardly get it done with notice to come in and tell the judge. They walked in, they got it done without even giving us notice. If he only had given us notice, we could have come in and explained the lies in the petitions that they filed and the affidavits. And you see, there were conclusions. They said, oh, they are shredding files. But tell me, who saw whom shred a file, or whatever the proper grammatical structure would be of that? Who? Nobody. Nobody. A minister in charge of a church, and this will tell you then how much credence you can give this man. Supposed to be leading a flock here, taking God's money, and he files an affidavit on there. And he says, oh, a lot of people told me files were being shredded, but he didn't give one single example. It's the same man that says, oh, I'm a relative of Mr. Armstrong, and I can tell you, he's getting senile. He is senile. I tell you, I can stack up articles, and that's what we did for the attorney that had to go into court because we couldn't. We were named as defendants. I could stack up articles that he had written, Mr. Armstrong had written in the last month, more than the other man had written all his life. And he's supposed to be senile. See, all you got to do is talk to him and you'll find out. You can see I'm emotionally involved in this thing. I haven't even got past my first notes. See, and I don't want to keep, you know, downing people, but you have to understand who the loyal people are. That's the only reason I'm going to mention names here. My first thought was, look, these people have been in this fellowship. Mr. Wayne Cole, get him on the line, because these people have not yet been this fellowship, as I understood it. They may not have been, because of the policy that was established by Mr. Ted Armstrong. You don't put anybody out of the church. And as a consequence, regardless of how wicked or wrong they are, the thing festers and festers and festers, you see. Contrary to Mr. Herbert Armstrong's instructions, that says you got to keep the church clean. If a person causes division, you put them out. But that rule was changed, so it permitted these people to be in and say they were members and be able to file this suit. So I tried to call Mr. Cole. You know, where is he? Could you disfellowship these people? The greatest battle in God's church is taking place now. They have police up there in the ad building. They're going to take all the files. And I can't find Mr. Cole. Where's the general? Where's the captain? He's gone. He's disappeared. Well, later we found out he happened to be down to Mr. Herbert Armstrong. He had left. No one would tell us where he was. He comes back with a certain document appointing himself in charge of certain things that enabled him to all of a sudden end up, quote, in charge of the church, close quote. Okay, we didn't know that. See, all these pieces didn't all fall together. You see what I'm getting at? There's a little snatch here, a little snatch here. This is unusual. That's strange. So on and so forth. See, I'll be keeping you here for another hour. I can see that it's the way I'm going. So I'm just going to cut this very, very short. The receiver was here. He was appointed. He took charge of everything. Although I think he was a responsible man, he went far beyond any authority that could ever be given him by a court of law. And that was exemplified here just recently in this court order. You see, because we have no concerns of somebody looking at our records. The Internal Revenue had just spent 18 months going through our records. There's nothing to hide in the records. In fact, what they attached to their petition, you understand, was our records. That's what's supposed to be the sneaky thing. We had records. And what they attached was the pastor's report, where all the information had been sent to all the pastors in the field. It wasn't somebody saying, hey, I got some secret inside information that nobody knows about. It was our own records they had cited. The attorney general had full authority to come in and say, I'd like to look at your records. We can say, here, sure, here they are. But all of a sudden, somebody's banging on the door and wants to take those records. with a little bit of thinking later, begin to fall in place today, and I mentioned it. Those records are our salvation here, insofar as a physical matter is concerned, because they show that no wrong has been done. But now, all of a sudden, dissident church members are going to get their hands on those records and carry them out of this building, and I begin to see that once they had accomplished that, we would lose the very protection to show that we're innocent. You see that? And you know what they said? The only evidence they had was that we had a file shredder someplace. Well, Mr. Rader didn't even know it. I didn't know. We were already putting an affidavit. We don't even have a file shredder. But I'll tell you, I know they got a file shredder, chances are. You see, here's the point. Again, when we were in court, rumor comes out, Mr. Henry Cornwall has taken $52,000 from the work. $52 million. How do you even carry it out? But you see, how in the world are you going to show such things to be false if your records are gone? How can you do it? They said the Big Sandy property was worth $30 million. The only basis they had was a newspaper article. That's all they had. I tell you, we'd sell it tomorrow for $30 million. But you see the stupidity. They're saying it's worth $30 million, but they're not saying that we're selling it to a friend of ours. They're not saying that we got an in with it, that we got part of the business. But you see the silly allegations? So with that, we saw, just coming back here, so I saw the importance, and pretty soon this conspiracy began to kind of take hold. If the dissidents can get hold of the records, they would disappear. We'd probably never see them again. Then how are you going to defend? What do you have to show? You see, just like this property value now, we have an appraisal. The appraisal shows it was worth less than what we got it for. But you see, that file was in somebody else's possession now. Now, what would happen if that appraisal disappears? How are we going to show that we did the right thing? So you see how dangerous that was. So you see, don't misunderstand this battle. One thing I want to do is get clear in your mind the issues. We are not trying to hide the records. There is nothing to hide. The only factor is we are not about to sit back and let a man come here and say, Mr. Armstrong, you are out. And I tell you, you should see the dedication of the people that came down to court to test to that. You should see the dedication of the people that were down at this law office when we were working down there till 5 o'clock in the morning. People came from all over this work to help out. Calling Mr. Walter Dickinson last night to late hours, and he's running all over. He said, you want me to go back some more? I'll go back some more. I tell you, there's one thing this has done. It has brought this church, I feel, together so much stronger than it's ever been before. It's given it a renewed faith, because now we do have, for the first time, persecution. People used to tell me they had persecution because they did something wrong on a job and they were fired. It's not persecution. You earned it. But this is persecution here. So I say, you got to keep the issues clear. Don't let somebody tell you we're trying to hide the records. We of all people want to protect those records. We are willing to show them to responsible individuals. IRS has consistently been in here looking at them. You got to understand that. So don't let people, dupe you. So the battle was to protect the records, and most of all, the battle was to keep Mr. Herbert Armstrong and head of this church. If God wants him out, God will remove him. And nobody from the state is going to do it, at least as long as God gives me power. And, of course, with the help of everybody else, I'll tell you, this wasn't a one-man job. Just fortunate we could pull together a lot of people from the church that had the help to get the thing accomplished. So it became very clear, frankly. I got a letter here. I'm not going to bother reading all these things. It just so happens. Again, the last piece falls together today. We're at Mr. Armstrong's place. Mrs. Armstrong says, hey, I just happened to get a letter in here. You want to? I haven't even read it. I said, yeah, let me read it here. And boy, there it is. words before, this poor sheep, this poor lamb, innocent member out in the field, he can't understand what his local minister is doing. He can't understand the rumors that his local minister is passing out about a conspiracy where certain people are going to take over the church and Mr. Wayne Cole is going to lead it. This came to us just by happenstance today to kind of reconfirm. You see what I mean? Reconfirm everything that happened here as we're going to court. You see, I'm going to cut a lot of things out of this here. But the thing that really hit home after we worked all night one night, and I'm not just talking about that, I'm just saying preparing everything to go to court. And we go to court to get the receiver put out. Now remember, the receiver was appointed by the state. He came in, and after certain consultations with Mr. Cole, right, he appointed Mr. Cole, he reconfirmed, put his appointment in, as head of the church. Because Mr. Armstrong has been, quote, out of the church, close quote. So Mr. Cole is in the top of the church, the leader, and who put him in now? The receiver. Okay, the receiver. He was the one appointed, remember now. Okay, so now we have a different man in charge of the church, and they were having lunch together, and all of a sudden Mr. Cole is telling everybody, now look, you cooperate with this receiver. You do exactly what he wants. Remember, the receiver is running the church now, both spiritually and physically, right? And you obey that receiver. Mr. LaRavia says, no, listen, we can't do that. You know, Mr. Armstrong's in charge of this church, and this man, what did he say he's going to do? You know what they had the gall to say, the Attorney General, when he was up here? He not only said Mr. Armstrong was out, he said, this institution has been run too autocratic in the past. He says, henceforth, we're going to run it more along traditional lines. Now, can you imagine that? Somebody going into the Catholic Church, you know, just voting for this Pope here, that's pretty ridiculous. They said, you know, the whole Catholic Church didn't vote for him. But he's going to take over a church. I tell you, you can't just, this is so mind-boggling for anybody that's ever studied constitutional law. You can't believe it. But anyway, that was the statement, and that was what was not going to be permitted. And that's where the battle came, and the catalyst came. You see, so he had appointed Mr. Cole now, right? So then, I find out today, another piece that was put in the puzzle today that fit back there, Mr. Antion and Mr. Cole had called Mr. Herbert Armstrong and said, say, you know, Mr. Rader and Mr. Helge and the others, they got this attorney and they're all going to go into court and they're going to try to have this receiver removed, try to get him out of here. And I'm like, that's kind of unusual, isn't it? We should just let him here, I guess, you know? That's kind of strange. Well, I'll tell you, Mr. Armstrong, he was told, you shouldn't do that. Now, the attorney, they got the bum attorney anyway, and they don't quite know what they're doing. You should keep that receiver in there. And from Mr. Herbert Armstrong's lips today, he was given the ultimatum. Mr. Armstrong, you better keep that receiver in there and keep the attorney's receiver in there, or else you're going to be out. That's the ultimatum. And Mr. Armstrong said, look, we will participate willingly in any investigation. If it says we've committed the fraud, they can look at our records. But he says, I'm not going to back up 1 minute. They think they're going to run the church. That's what he told him, and he hung up that he wasn't going to accept the ultimatum. So then the big event occurred, and the thing that brought it home to my mind, you see, we didn't have all these facts. You think you're working all day and night, and facts got to come in, you see. And then we go down to court now, and we're ready to go in and have the receiver removed. We're going to battle for that, to protect our records, to get them back in our fold so we could protect them. Now, we're not saying you can't look at them, Attorney General. We're not saying that. We're saying we want the records in our possession. And we want you, receiver, out insofar as running the church, the temporal affairs of the church are concerned. We don't want you signing a check to the ministry. We don't want you saying we can't buy tapes. He stopped payment of checks that we're going to pay for tapes for the broadcast to go out. And he admitted at testimony last night the fact he was going to make decisions about the broadcast and everything else. And we didn't want that. So we're ready to go to court now, mind you. And what's the first thing the attorney for the dissident pulls out? He said, hey, we have here, Your Honor, a letter from Mr. Wayne Cole. He has been appointed as head of the church. And he has confirmed the receiver running the church. Therefore, the receiver, seeing he's in charge of the church with Mr. Wayne Cole, does not want these men, Mr. Rader, Helge, this other attorney, to have any authority to represent the church to put the receiver out. You see what that would have done? That would have effectively put Mr. Herbert out of the Armstrong off this church for good. It would have put the receiver in charge of everything and Mr. Wayne Cole in charge of everything and certain other ones. And we could not even have spoken in court to even say what the people wanted. We would have been effectively barred from that. But with the help of God, that case didn't go to trial there. Because it kept juggling around before one judge and another judge. And the time began to eat up and eat up. So finally they said, no, we have to hear it tomorrow. And that gave us more time for Mr. Armstrong to learn of it. And then rechange a different document he had been forced to sign so that he could be represented. I tell you, if I had time to tell you the different things that fall into place. Then all of a sudden we're down there working and we get word. Somebody has gone into the computer department and they're trying to get the computer cranked up. Because I could see that they were going to go ahead and send a letter out to the membership saying somebody else was in charge of the church, you see, that Mr. Herbert Armstrong was out, and so on. I tried to call the police immediately. I said, there's a break-in down there. I said, get down there. He said, oh, I know you people are having trouble over there. I don't think I want to go. I said, look, I happen to be the secretary of that church, and I'm the attorney for it, and I'm telling you to get down there. He said, well, I know about the trouble. I said, look, I don't care what trouble you've heard about. Does that make us fair game for a bunch of burglars? See? He said, well, okay. He said, I'll send somebody down, but if I send somebody down, there's no break-in. He said, they went in with a key. Well, if there's no break-in, I'm not going to do anything. I said, but they have access there to a membership list that's worth millions of dollars. I'm just not going to do anything. By the time I call and Mr. Dickinson runs out there and so on, they're already gone. It's ghastly. Look what happened. It's all over. We've got the membership list. Now they're going to put themselves in control insofar as the memberships are concerned. You know what the facts are? The computer wouldn't start. So I tell you, we're great believers that you got to have, you know, that faith without works is dead. I'll believe that. I'm telling you, you've got to have works to supplement your faith. But as somebody else very astutely said, works without faith is dead, yes, but works, if faith without works is dead, but works without faith is useless. So things worked out to where the court has basically changed the court order. Then during the night, we made some calls. I began to keep thinking all the loyal ministers that we knew. This is not an exhaustive list. We got on the phone right away, and I tried to get in touch with Mr. Norman Smith to get him down, to get Mr. Dean Blackwell down, George Meeker, and of course, there are many others, Dennis Luker, and we immediately called Mr. McNair and Mr. Meredith. And that doesn't mean to say it's an exhaustive list. Please, I'm just giving a few names here that happen to be down there. Because there are many faithful ministers. But with that, then, things were put together, and we went to court, and the court changed the court order to a very large degree, as Mr. Rader told you, saying that Mr. Herbert Armstrong is the one that has authority to hire and fire. And you see, with that inspired decision, it gave the chance for Mr. Armstrong to clean house. And I'll say clean house of conspirators. You see, there were problems I can't even tell you about. Now, we couldn't understand the rumors going out. They weren't being squelched. Ministers calling, I need information to squelch them. I said, well, guess it's not my job. You know, you got an area especially for that. They weren't being fed with the proper information. And you see, all this now has come out. This suit, actually, I feel was inspired by Satan. But I'll tell you, I believe that God is just making use of it, you see, in such a way as to build unity in the church and to bring forth this conspiracy. And I say, in closing, I just want to make one more brief thing. I tell you, I feel there was a source of rumors, but I feel it's out of the church right now. But I'll tell you, in that source of rumors, which is ultimately by Satan using certain instruments, there's one man that has constantly and continuously been castigated, and that's Mr. Rader. Now, I know I am, quote, a Rader man, close quote, so anything I say is highly suspect. You see, it so happens that when Mr. Rader got his law degree, oh, then it was just the opposite. Then it was probably Helgi got a lot of trouble with Mr. Rader, very jealous probably, because he, next to Mr. Armstrong, got his law degree. At that time, I was his antagonist, according to the rumor, and now all of a sudden, of course, I'm in his hip pocket, so to speak. Well, I tell you, neither has been true. We just have a great admiration for each other. But I want to tell you something about this man that I feel I must. And this comes from my heart. And Mr. Herbert Armstrong gives me my pay, not Mr. Rader, you understand? Okay. That so many times over the years, you see, all these rumors against Mr. Rader, how he does this and so on and so forth, but so many times when he didn't have to tell me. You see, I'm in a lesser position than Mr. Rader. I'm not ashamed to say that. I am. So he doesn't have to try to build himself up in my eyes in any way. But you know, so many times on small things, he continuously, never endingly, always, tell you, lauded Mr. Herbert W. Armstrong. He always told me about his tremendous judgment. He always told me. Every time something happened. Say, you know something? Mr. Armstrong said that was going to happen. He said that man was that way. But I said no. And I fought with him. And I argued with him. You know? But he was right. And he tells me every time. It happens every time. He says people don't realize how great that man is. The people don't realize how inspired he is. They don't realize the judgment he has. He has consistently built up Mr. Armstrong. I'll tell you, that's given me great faith in Mr. Rader, that I, in turn, have defended him over the years. And you know, they say he controls Mr. Herbert Armstrong. Well, I'll tell you, all you got to do is know Mr. Armstrong and you know better. But it's very interesting recently. Very interesting. I gave Mr. Rader a kind of a 8-paragraph document saying, look, here's a recommendation I'd like to make. I really think this is a real good idea, and here it is. He looks at it. Say, you know, I think you got something here. I really think this is good, and I'm going to present it to Mr. Armstrong. Now, he's supposed to control Mr. Armstrong, right? Calls me back the next day. He says, I want to tell you something. You know, he said, you really kind of did it in for me, he said. You know, he says, I brought that document to Mr. Armstrong. He says, he not only rejected and struck out each paragraph, some he struck out twice. See? So I tell you, if he controls Mr. Armstrong, he's got a funny way of showing it, because his whole idea was shot down the tube. Listen, I just want to thank you very much. I shouldn't say thank you, but I do want to thank you for the support that so many of you gave when we were in court. You know, when it was all over, after all the stress and strain and I'm leaving, there are three couples out there, kind of dark-skinned, Puerto Rican, Mexican, I don't know. They said, oh, Mr. Helgi. I said, yes, yeah, you know, about 9 o'clock, you see. She'd like to talk to you. Well, sure, fine. What's the story, you know? So here they talk, and they just say, boy, you know, we're so happy the way things are, and we're so happy to hear Mr. Armstrong there. And they just kind of pour their hearts out in a very simplistic, loving way. You see, not edifying themselves. When we go outside, what do I find? But here it's 9 o'clock at night. The buses have left, and they had no transportation. Here they are standing in the rain. They didn't even bother to grab a bus to go home. They were so dedicated to stay down there in the pouring rain without means of transportation, just to back the church down there. As I'm saying, I feel God is using this, and there's one way is to go ahead and bring this church into something we've lost under Mr. Ted Armstrong, and that's the idea of prayer, of faith, and fellowship. I tell you, we from a physical standpoint, I know we pushed very hard to make certain that certain leading ministers could be back in positions again, and one that I know that we've all pushed for, and that was for Mr. Meredith here. So, I tell you, I know he had a lot of things to say. His sermons have always been good, so let's keep an ear attuned so we can just all really, through that type of preaching, you know, come to a oneness again and just be together.
I guess we better raise Mr. Helge's salary. Well, maybe we will. I'm just kidding. We keep you people over 3 hours and you're still clapping. I think this is really like the old days in that way. Do you know that our average service, the normal service time in God's church up in the library, used to be for years 1:30 to 4:30 every Sabbath, and Mr. Armstrong often ran over a half an hour or so, and that's all we're doing now. And I thought I was going to come up and Mr. Rader, you know, would say a few things, and I'd give a final scripture and inspire you and sit down. But really, Mr. Helge's done such a good job, and you've been here a long time, and I think you're probably ready to sing. But I just want to say that most of you know Mr. Helge, I'm sure, but he has been a church member for 20 or more years. I've known him very, very well, worked with him a very great deal, very dedicated. Remember, he used to be one of Dr. Hayes' roomers in Dr. Hayes' house, I think, for years before he got married. And we kid him about being a bachelor and married one of our fine college girls, and is a very dedicated church member working for Jesus Christ, not just for any man. And we're all working for Christ and humanly for Mr. Armstrong. So I'm very grateful for his comments in Mr. Armstrong and, of course, in the work's defense. That's the main thing. So anyway, hang in there. I hope all of you will do that. And I hope all of you will pray a whole lot for the other brethren who might not have been able to be here and get the story as thorough as you did here. Let's remember them. Thanks a whole lot. We'll have the singing now.